I don't know what does it take to stop all of that. And we have seen what's going on in the hospital, in Shifa Hospital, is a crime. It's a crime against the humanity. I don't know how these people are humans, how they feel for their brothers and sisters who allow this massacre to happen in Al-Shifa Hospital. And allow me to say this. The Israelis are targeting Al-Shifa Hospital and other hospitals not because there is Hamas base in it. Of course, they know that there is no Hamas there. These are public areas and everyone, like, they are taped and filmed all the time. There's no Hamas inside Al-Shifa Hospital, but Israel wants to destroy Al-Shifa Hospital in order to force everyone who live north of the valley to go south. Because people are taking refuge in these hospitals, so Israel are bombing these hospitals so that they end all the shelters for the refugees, and that's when they will be forced to move south. So all these allegations that Hamas members or military bases and Al-Shifa Hospital, other hospital, is absurd. Now, a country or an army that is willing and capable of killing 5,000 Palestinian kids while they were sleeping in their homes, including 14 of my nieces and nephews, is capable of lying and saying that there is Hamas in the hospital. This is a lie, and the world should know. The world should know better. Now we have social media. We see the truth as it is. And I do not give any excuse for anyone who believes or buys the Israeli narrative about what's going on in this conflict, because this army is a killer, is a murderer, and they are, of course, capable of lying, as they have lied for many, many, many years before.
Ahmed Al-Naouk, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of We Are Not Numbers. At least 20 members of his family have been killed in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas attack, including his father and several siblings. His recent piece for The Nation is headlined, "Palestinians Just Want to Be Treated Like Human Beings." We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Next up, we speak with two journalists, the award-winning Jasmine Hughes, forced to resign from the New York Times Magazine after signing an open letter criticizing Israel. We also speak to the writer Jamie Lauren Kalis, who's leaving the New York Times as well. Back in 30 seconds.
See, I hope that it's gonna be all right, but what a hell of a night. Humanity is a privilege we can't give in. When they build walls, we'll build bridges. This is resistance, we're resilient. And they spread hate, we shine brilliant. Marched by the millions, till they hear the children. We free ourselves at a distance. Open up the jails and the overcrowded cells. When we oppress anyone, we oppress ourselves. Greatest gift I ever learned.
Wednesday morning by Macklemore, who addressed the pro-ceasefire rally in Washington, D.C. last week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at how Israel's bombardment of Gaza is creating turmoil in newsrooms. The New York Times Magazine's award-winning writer Jasmine Hughes was recently forced to resign after signing an open letter condemning Israel's siege on Gaza. In an email to the staff, the magazine editor, Jake Silverstein, wrote, "While I respect that she has strong convictions, this was a clear violation of the Times' policy on public protest. This policy, which I fully support, is an important part of our commitment to independence," he said. Jasmine Hughes is an acclaimed journalist who won a National Magazine Award earlier this year for her profiles of Viola Davis and Whoopi Goldberg in the New York Times. She also worked on the Times' prize-winning 1619 project about the role of slavery in the United States. Her last piece was about Danny DeVito and his daughter Lucy starring in a Broadway play. Meanwhile, a contributor at the New York Times Magazine, who signed the same letter criticizing Israel, Jamie Lauren Kalis, has announced he'll no longer write for the publication. He's a transgender journalist who describes himself as a, quote, religiously observant Jew. In a message on social media, he said it was a, quote, personal decision about what kind of work I want to be able to do. The letter they both signed read in part, quote, "We stand in opposition to the silencing of dissent and to racist and revisionist media cycles further perpetuated by Israel's attempts to bar reporting in Gaza, where journalists have been both denied entry and targeted by Israeli forces. We condemn those in our industries who continue to enable apartheid and genocide. We cannot write a free Palestine into existence. But together, we must do all we possibly can to reject narratives that soothe Western Western complicity in ethnic cleansing, they wrote. Jasmine Hughes and Jamie Lauren Kalis join us together in their first broadcast interview. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jasmine, let's begin with you. Talk about your decision that led to your forced resignation from the New York Times to sign the letter. Why did you choose to sign on?
I signed on to the letter as mostly a conscientious person. I felt so overwhelmed by the media that I was seeing, the reports that I was hearing. And I don't purport to be an expert on the situation by any means. Admittedly, I'm pretty belated to the entire approach, and I wanted to personally hold myself accountable. But what really stuck out to me about the letter is that the letter was addressed in part to other news organizations, other journalists that spoke about workplace violations, harassment that people were facing, that spoke about the ways in which the conflict is being covered. And I considered it a conversation within the industry that I wanted to be a part of.
And could you talk a little about what your concerns were about how it was being covered by the Times?
Well, I don't want to speak about particular ways that it was covered by the New York Times, but just in general, I felt as if I wanted to be part of this conversation that really held the industry itself to a particular standard. And also, I felt personally implicated as a taxpaying American, and I wanted to hold myself accountable for these sorts of things. With regard to the Times's coverage, I didn't have anything particular about the Times' coverage. I just wanted to speak to the matter at large.
And this whole issue, obviously, of objectivity within mainstream or commercial journalism, your sense of how it's been applied over the years?
I think that objectivity is a wonderful, beautiful project for a world that does not exist, right? And I think that, I guess specifically within the Times, but in mainstream media writ large, that the recent, like, diversification of newsrooms has been a great boon, I think, to both coverage and to people's, like, egos. But what happens when we suddenly have, like, an influx of people with different identities, different experiences, and different wants in a newsroom? I signed the letter as an employee of the New York Times, but as a Black person, as a queer person, as a woman. And, you know, all these identities have all of those identities or all of the communities thereof have been awarded their rights by agitation, right? By protest. And I, as a person at the core of all these identities, wanted to amplify that effort. And I think that... Sorry, that's it.
Well, Jasmine, you've talked about the awards you've won for your writing, like the A National Magazine Award, being from a very subjective point of view, and that's your power. That's what you win the awards for. Can you amplify on that?
Sure. I had won three awards during my tenure as a writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. One for being under 30, which I am no longer. One for writing a story about coming out as a lesbian, and one for writing these stories on, like stated, on Viola Davis and Whoopi Goldberg. And all of these stories were predicated in some part on my identity. I think the biggest difference, or I guess the biggest note that I want to make, that I signed that letter as a magazine journalist, right? I wasn't working in the newsroom. I wasn't doing the sort of stories where you take the sort of, like, distant, authoritative stance where you are presenting unbiased and filtered facts. Every story that I've written from the New York Times has been, like, through my very real identity and experiences. The fact that I've written so many stories with the word we, right, that can refer to any group of people, any sort of community that I'm a part of, already puts me in a situation where I didn't purport to try to write or continue the sort of the standards of the newsroom, of the actual New York Times. I think that I was writing, or all the stories I wrote had a particular voice, and I think that voice translated onto the letter because it's me, and That's what makes sense.
Well, let's bring Jamie Lauren Kalis into this conversation. You also resigned from the New York Times Magazine. You're a transgender Jewish writer, a self-described observant Jew. You were a New York Times Magazine contributor. Talk about your decision.
Yeah, so first and foremost, I signed the letter as a person. I feel like growing up as a Jew in America, you're asked all the time, what would people do if there was another Holocaust? And for me, it was just really important to say, this is the time when you're supposed to speak up. Like, this is the moment that you've been hypothetically asked about your entire life. So journalism aside, I signed it as a person, and I think it's the right thing to do. And I wouldn't support an ethnostate anywhere else in the world for any other group, and I don't support it for my own people. So that was first and foremost why I signed the letter. The secondary question of sort of why did I sign it as a journalist has to do a little bit about with questions about sort of what do we expect of contingent labor. Jasmine's a staffer, but I'm a contributing writer for the magazine, which means I don't have benefits. I don't have any kind of protections. So that's how most of the journalism in our industry is currently being produced in this moment, by contingent laborers. And I think there's this bigger question of, like, if an institution is not willing to give you a job, then what do you owe them, right? And I think, like, I'm not, as someone that doesn't have job security and isn't protected and doesn't have access to the labor rights that a union grants, I think it's, like, incumbent upon me to be owning my own platform as much as possible, right? I owe nothing to the institution of the Times if the Times gives nothing to me. And I think that, to me, the commitment to signing the letter, beyond the fact that I just think it's the correct statement to make, it's a little bit of a protest of this idea that just because you're a person who produces news, and like Jasmine, like, I cover celebrities, you know, this is not my main topic, but it's the idea that the magazine or the Times as a whole would have some hold on my speech just seemed ludicrous to me. So in some way, it was a small amount of protest over the labor conditions in the industry at large.
So in other words, what you're saying is the Times holds you to the code of conduct of an employee, but then does not provide you the benefits or the protections of an employee. What did the editors say to you once the letter had come out?
I mean, it's a little less clear than that, right? Because, like, there's not formal statements saying what contributors and what 1099 workers can or cannot say, right? And when you go say, hey, where's the line? Like, what is political speech and what is a statement of fact? Like, it's very hard to get a clear answer on that. So I signed the letter. This was the second letter I signed. I signed an earlier letter regarding the paper's coverage of trans issues, and I was reprimanded for that. And they said, well, you know, you can't sign this letter because it singled out the work of other writers specifically within the institution. And I said to that, well, I don't work here, so I don't know what you're talking to me about. And I signed this letter and resigned shortly after because I felt a reprimand was coming, which Jasmine's situation on some level seems to have borne out. But the biggest frustration, I think, from the labor perspective is that when you asked, what are the guidelines, where are the hard boundaries of what kind of speech is acceptable for a Times contributor and not, there's no written guidelines. People will tell you vague things on the phone, like my editor did, such as, like, well, you can attend street protests and post on social media, but don't make a big thing about it, right? So, like, to me, it's a little bit of a question of, like, are there clear rules about this? What types of objectivity are we maintaining to be, like, the requirement for doing this job? And then it's incumbent upon me to accept or reject those things or not. But as long as it's this vague triangulation about, like, well, you know, there's kind of just a vibe about what types of speech are okay. Like, I just, as someone that's, like, trying to do intellectually honest work and be in pursuit of truth in some sense, whether or not a totally objective position is possible, I think it's really important, especially as the industry becomes more and more centered on people who do this kind of 1099 contingent work, to have clear guidelines for what is expected of journalists who are doing this work.
Jamie, I was wondering your response, and if you were part of the protests last week. It was just after Jasmine had resigned. The large group of media workers who led a march to the New York Times and later occupied the paper's building entrance for over an hour, denouncing what demonstrators called biased reporting toward Israel. Protesters read the names at the time of at least 36 journalists. It's now over 40 journalists killed by Israeli fire in Gaza. It's 40 altogether, also involving Lebanon, and distributed mock newspapers with the words "The New York Crimes," accusing the Times with complicity in laundering genocide. Also, people like Nan Rubin announced that, Nan Golden announced that she would end her project, her collaboration with the New York Times, the well-known artist. Jamie, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I did attend the outside march in support of the action that was led by Writers Against the War on Gaza, which is the group that produced the letter that Jasmine and I both signed. I don't necessarily think my anger is focused specifically on the New York Times, because, like, while they are indicative of a broader problem with the industry, I think this is, like, an industry-wide question, right? So, like, the Times, as, like, one of the quote-unquote paper of record, becomes the center of this conversation, but, like, it's by no means exclusive to the Times, and, like, my particular employment situation there really is, like, not that critical when we think about the broader issue, right? To me, the media questions around it, right, it's, like, critical thinking skills that journalists would be expected to apply to any other situation, right? And cover stuff like providing historical context or thinking about, like, the semantics of, like, power within certain language that's chosen, even things like the Times naming their vertical the Israel-Hamas war versus perhaps, like, the Israel-Palestine war or the Israel-Gaza war, right? There are all these choices that are being made. Things like, I was really, really disheartened to see the CNN embed with the IDF, right? Like, there are all these ideas about, like, journalistic objectivity, but then when it actually comes down to the level of, like, news being produced, things we would expect of news coverage on any other topic are totally being forgotten here. And I just think, like, any attempts to silence journalists' pushback to this, it seems to me to be, like, in some way an endorsement of Israel's actions, right? So, like, all I think that beyond a ceasefire, which is my personal demand, as far as an industry demand, all I'm asking for is fair, reasonable coverage that you would expect of any other topic.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us in this first broadcast interview you've done. Jamie Lauren Kalis resigned from the New York Times Magazine, as did Jasmine Hughes. Jamie Lauren Kalis is a contributor, and Jasmine was a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Next up, we look at how the United States and other nations are helping to arm Israel in its assault on Gaza. We'll speak with Anthony Lowenstein, author of The Palestine Laboratory. Stay with us. Gaelic song An Philistin by Sharon Shannon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The weapons Israel is using in its assault on Gaza have become a major focus of protests calling for a ceasefire. In the United Kingdom Friday, hundreds of demonstrators blockaded the country's biggest weapons manufacturer, BAE Systems, to call for the end of weapon sales to Israel. This comes as union members in Belgium and Spain have refused to handle shipments of military material over the war in Gaza. Here in the U.S., 9 peace activists were arrested Monday for blockading entrances to the engineering complex of General Dynamics in Connecticut, where nuclear submarines are designed, and said, quote, "We're seeking to make connections between General Dynamics' preparation for nuclear war here in New London and Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza," they said. Meanwhile, in Australia, hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters block the Israeli Zim shipping line from docking at Sydney's port, Botany, saying it is a major shipper of arms to Israeli forces currently waging war on Gaza. Over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of pro-Palestine protesters took to the streets of Sydney, of Melbourne, of Brisbane, to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Australia's reportedly approved over 50 military exports export permits to Israel this year alone, and three Palestinian human rights organizations in Australia and the UK have filed legal challenges to suspend them. For more, we're joined in Sydney, Australia, by Anthony Lowenstein, an independent journalist who's investigated how Israeli weaponry and surveillance technology is used on Palestinians and exported around the world. His most recent book, published in May, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. He was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Anthony Lowenstein. If you can start off by talking about this issue of weapons and also speak from your background as a Jewish reporter.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy and Juan. Look, what's been happening since October 7 with the arms to Israel really in some ways fits into a long pattern. You've had since that day the US, UK, Germany, Australia, Netherlands, many other countries rush ship huge amounts of weapons to Israel, including, I might add, F-35, which is a fighter jet that Israel's been using. And there's a global supply chain, and many countries, including Australia, the US, and Netherlands, are sending parts to Israel, which almost certainly are being used over Gaza as we speak. In fact, the German arms exports to Israel have expanded 10 times in the last month since 2022, a massive increase. And I think what you see really is a growing global awareness of the connection between Israeli militarism and the arms industry. Now, it might be obvious to many on the left that that's been the case for many, many years, long before October 7. But I think you see in some ways a growing public awareness and anger. The longer this conflict is going on, the death toll is so staggering. The amount of civilians being killed is so overwhelming. The footage that we're all seeing, and understanding the connection between how that's happening and who's actually funding and supporting that. Yes, obviously Israel's the one that's actually doing the killing in Gaza, but there's a deep global connection to many Western partners that are funding, backing and arming it. And I think ultimately, finally, I'd say that there is a growing Jewish awareness of this. Now, obviously, I speak as someone who's Jewish. I'm Australian, but also a German citizen. And I think it's clear that for a long time there's been Jewish criticism of Israel, that's for sure. But in the last years, particularly since the Gaza war in 2014, and especially this year, the devastation we've seen since the horrific Hamas attack on October 7, growing Jewish voices, not just in relation to protesting Israeli actions, but the arms that many Western countries are sending to Israel to fight its brutal war.
Anthony, could you talk about how Israel and especially Gaza have become a laboratory for surveillance states? You write, for instance, that the system is most extreme in the city of Hebron, where facial recognition and numerous cameras are used to monitor Palestinians, including at times in their homes, instead of the extreme Jewish settlers who are routinely attacking them. You talk about that and also what's happening and what's been happening in Gaza even before the war.
You know, one of the things I talk about a lot in my book, Juan, in the Palestine Laboratory, is how in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem for years, Israel regularly tests and trials new weapons. That could be drones, spyware, as you say, facial recognition technology. And Gaza for years was framed as the ultimate laboratory. There were 2.3 million Palestinians. There was a fence that essentially was constructed around the entire perimeter. It was almost impossible to break out. Of course, we saw that and not a reality on October 7, which I'll get to in a minute. But ultimately, there were huge amounts of technologies. But one I think you find after October 7, and I've heard this both from sources that I've been speaking to, but also some decent reporting in the last month, is this in some ways was a tech lack of imagination, a tech failure, a tech lack of imagination, a tech arrogance. And what I mean by that is that Israel had believed arrogantly for years that it was possible to cage 2.3 million people indefinitely and they would never break out and resist that. And even to the point where in the year before the attack, I've been hearing reports that Israel and the NSA, the US's key spy agency, stopped listening into Hamas walkie-talkies, for example, just didn't listen to it in the belief they didn't need to, that certain Jewish communities near the Gaza border were giving information they were hearing
back to Israeli military intelligence, which the government ignored. Now, on the one hand, it was an intelligence catastrophe, not unlike 9/11 in the US, but it was more than that. It was a political failure, Netanyahu being the prime minister, the obvious one. And I think what it shows is, as I talk about in the book extensively, that you can have all the repressive technology you want in the world. You can repress people, surveil them, monitor their homes, document them in any way possible. And Israel is tragically a global leader in this, which they then export to huge amounts of nations around the world. But ultimately, it won't work. It can work, in inverted commas, for a certain amount of time, and you can convince other countries that it does work. But when something like October 7 happens, we see the complete failure. Having said that, and this is an important caveat to this, you know, ultimately, I think this will have no impact on Israel's arms industry. In fact, I think it's actually going to help. And let me briefly explain what I mean by that. The failure on October 7 was clear, but I think many countries will want to support Israel now moving forward. After the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Israeli arms sales have soared, massively soared. And I think what you'll find is that, like after 9/11, the US defense industry massively benefited from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Israel is already, as we speak, as I've been documenting in the last month, live testing new weapons in Gaza, showing it on social media, how they're working. That's not just for a domestic and international public, but also other countries that might want to buy those weapons in months and years ahead.
And I wanted to ask you, in terms of countries selling weapons to Israel, you talk about the difficulty in Australia in even finding out what the government is doing in terms of its exporting of arms to Israel.
You know, the American arms industry is hardly one you would call moral, but at least at times there's a degree of transparency, although I do note that after the Biden administration has sent huge amounts of weapons to Ukraine, there was a degree of listing what weapons were being sold, whereas with Israel in the last month, there's been barely any acknowledgement of what America actually is selling to Israel, though we have certain suspicions. Australia is an interesting case. Australia is a middle power. We are very, very madly pro-Israel, sadly, as a government. And for years and years, the Australian arms industry has been boosted by both sides of politics in my country. They've wanted to make it one of the top 10 or 20 arms exporters in the world, which it now is. It sold weapons to Saudi Arabia that they used in their genocidal war against Yemen. And in the last years, a number of activists, lawyers and journalists, including me, have tried to find out some details about what exactly is going on with the Australian arms industry to Israel. And I should say that I'm one of the co-founders of Declassified Australia, a news organization, and recently we published this amazing report which detailed how Pine Gap, which is a key US intelligence asset in the center of Australia, is being used by the Americans to provide real-time intelligence to the Israelis in their war against Gaza. Now, Pine Gap has been used for decades in US war-making in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the idea that you have a key American intelligence asset in the center of Australia giving information to Israel, which directly implicates Australian officials and government in what Israel is doing in Gaza. And this report went viral a few weeks ago, which I think it explains how there's so much concern that the US's presence in Australia and therefore assisting Israel in its war against Gaza from Australian shores should something that concern all of us deeply.
Anthony Lowenstein, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Anthony Lowenstein is an independent journalist who's investigated how Israeli weaponry and surveillance technology is used on Palestinians and exported around the world. Also a filmmaker and the author of many books, including his most recent, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. He was based in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. We'll also link to your latest piece in the New Internationalist headlined, How Palestine Became Israel's Spyware Testbed. That does it for our show. Belated happy birthday to Ishmael Daro. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
We really appreciate your generosity. Each year for a week, we host Fundrive, our annual fundraising campaign that boosts our budget and supports independent radio. Thank you for your support.